From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
In a week that saw U.S. President Donald Trump pull the U.S. out of the JCPOA agreement with Iran, there were reports of a secret white paper showing that the U.S. intends to help facilitate regime change in the Islamic Republic. For more on that, and the situation in general, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, international analyst and senior lecturer in geopolitics at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow Friday. Well, Mark, for me, the most troubling thing here, of course, we have to wait to see how it actually turns out, but, you know, we're hearing the, more than the grumblings, but this hearing about the circulation of a paper by Bolton's crew, at least in the deep background, calling for regime change in Iran and saying that what's, you know, being pursued right now is a policy to enable regime change. I remember, however, the standing ovation that Trump got at the Republican National Convention, much to my surprise, from the assembled Republicans saying no more regime change. And looks like they're going for it full steam, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a huge amount of difference between the Republican base that elected Trump and the neocons that are now essentially running the regime.
Right.
You know, John Bolton, Pompeo,
yeah.
and others. So what we're looking at is this all comes on the heels, of course, of Trump unilaterally pulling the U.S. out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The so-called nuclear deal,
right,
that was arranged between the U.S. and Iran and, of course, China and Russia and a number of the major European powers, UK, France, Germany, and so on. And it was fulfilled. It was fulfilled with a UN Security Council resolution,
right,
and with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has certified that Iran is not did not have an active nuclear weapons program.
That's right.
And has a fairly, by all accounts, when a number of even the DC establishment, the majority even, says is a stringent enough, that the U.S. doesn't need to worry about that.
Right.
So Trump pulling out of this came on the heels of a public theater put on by Benjamin Netanyahu, where he surrounded himself with binders and a white screen background with big letters, Iran lied, and so on. And this was obviously meant specifically for the consumption of Donald Trump, you know, personally. Netanyahu,
right,
obviously well aware that Trump doesn't like to read things. He likes things displayed in video format. So this was kind of a personal videogram from Netanyahu to Trump.
You know, let me say this much. As much as we heard at the Republican National Convention and leading up to it, the, you know, declared abandonment of, you know, the failure and abandonment of the project of regime change by coming out of Trump's mouth, and with full, you know, that helped get him the nomination, and I'm sure it helped get him elected as well. We also heard simultaneously that the Iran deal, terrible deal, we're going to redo it, it'll be a much better deal, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, he ran on, you know, against the JCPOA as well. And there was really no analysis done about the relationship between those two those two issues, which were, you know, glaring contradiction.
I think there was always a contradiction there.
I
think we all knew what we were hoping for is that Trump would turn away from regime change in Syria, and to some extent, you know, by some measures, he has. Yeah, he stopped Obama's program of funding jihadis, the CIA's long-term six 6-7 year program of arming, illegally arming, training, and salarying, sectarian Islamist and jihadist militants, literally allied and embedded with Al Qaeda. I mean, Trump stopped that, or at least significantly reduced it to a fairly large extent. Though it seems Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey picked up most of the slack in that regard. But they instead shifted their focus towards the Kurds, which had always been supported by the Pentagon, and they've, rather than giving up on the program of direct regime change by military force or by jihadi proxy in Damascus, they instead shifted to partition of eastern Syria, including the oil-heavy areas, and then attempt to leverage – the attempt will be to attempt to leverage that into a political regime change to accomplish politically and with economic blackmail the threat of a permanently – a partitioned and destabilized Syria to get what they want, regime change via another method there.
Right, and this was foreshadowed by Trump. As he was referring to the failure in Iraq, he was one of the primary failure that he saw, or at least that he articulated, or let me use a word that for Trump means articulate, but articulated that, you know, if I went in there, I would have taken the oil. Well, policy that follows with the Kurds, the particular Kurds, the Barzanis, for example, they are actually controlling some of that Iraqi oil. And so as you control them, you now are controlling it. And also, as you're talking about partition, you're talking about implementing exactly the policy that he had advocated should have been done in Iraq, which is to get the oil.
Yeah, well, see, this is the thing about that, because this close alignment with the Kurds, of course, costs the U.S. in relations with both Turkey and Iraq, both of which have their own rest of Kurdish population, have no desire to see an independent Syrian Kurdistan as an example or, continuing a struggle into their own countries. And on top of that, the oil doesn't do him much good. There's no pipelines. There's no way to get it out. It's pretty much just a spoiler. Right. It's denying the oil funds that are needed for reconstruction to the Syrian government. And I think that's more what control of that particular oil is about. They're hoping by economic and political blackmail to achieve what they failed to achieve militarily or by jihadi proxy this way instead. But we always knew that Trump and those around him were really hard on Iran, and we hoped that was further off in the distance, that Syria was always in the minds of the U.S. neocons just a stepping stone on the path to Iran, right? They viewed Iran, Syria, as a threat primarily. Part of it was gas pipelines from Qatar up to Europe. But, you know, the more important thing was it was denying Iran an ally with access to the Mediterranean. And of course, a close proximity to Hezbollah. So if you take out Syria or at least destabilize it, then you weaken Iran. And that was always the rationale behind the actions against Syria by the United States. But now, with Syria, at least starting to shift into a frozen conflict phase, at least as regards the U.S. and Turkey and the Syrian government, we have this move with the U.S. dropping the JCPOA, and it's accompanied at the exact same time by Israel increasing direct attacks in Syria on what it claims are Iranian forces in Syria. And it seems clear to me that this is and this has been backed up by the Duma member Slutsky, who is the head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Russian Duma. He said outright, this is part of a phased, planned series of provocations following on the heels of the withdrawal of the JCPOA, whose end goal is for Israel and for the neocons in the U.S. to draw the U.S. into a direct conflict with Iran. All right, and you know that we knew that was Trump's end game. We hoped it was a long way off, and that Russia might be able to forestall it. But it seems to be coming at least a little faster. I mean, we're not talking imminent. We're not talking carrier groups moving in the direction or today. Anything. But in a number of months, a year, I think we're definitely will be moving in that direction. And with this, Israel has now increased the frequency, the size and the depth of its airstrikes in Syria, again, supposedly targeting Iranian and previously Hezbollah forces. Right. They conducted over a dozen strikes. They claimed, of course, it was defense. There was an Israeli strike. That was what started it. Then Syria responded by firing missiles at Israeli forces in the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights. Israel claimed that this was Iran striking back against them. Iran has military advisors and special forces and militias in Syria, but it doesn't have 20 missile launch units, right. that sort of thing. That is clear. So that was of course nonsense. But Israel used that as an excuse to attack a large scale attack across Syria. 60 missiles, 60 air to ground missiles, 10 surface to surface missiles, involving nearly some 30 F-15s and F-16s, and at targets all over Syria. This was the largest Israeli attack on Syria in decades.
Yeah, since the 60s, right? Whereas we're early 70s. Yeah.
Now, the results of this, the number of deaths seems to have been extremely light.
Right.
There's no Syria and the Russian government say that the Syrian air defense systems alone managed to shoot down over half of these missiles. Mm. Now, Russia did not even turn on its air defense systems to defend Syria once again. Mm. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Moscow the day before the attacks, nominally as a guest of honor of the Victory Day celebrations, celebrating, the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Netanyahu was with Putin for some 10 hours. And we can only presume they had extensive discussions. Primarily, to my mind, was the delivery of S-300 systems. After the most recent U.S. and some earlier Israeli attacks, we have to remember that Israel has illegally and aggressively attacked Syria over 100 times since 2011. And for the most part, until the most recent months, Syria has never attacked back. They have never taken any type – they've rarely even turned on their air defense systems. And this is because they were hoping under Russia's tutelage, we can presume, to avoid a direct escalation, avoiding these obvious provocations of a direct war with Israel, which would lead right to a direct war with the United States. They hope to keep concentrating on the ground, on the proxies, which of course Israel and the U.S. and Saudi and Turkey and Qatar and the U.K. and others were backing. They hope to win the ground on the fight on the ground for territory against the proxies, but never engage with the the masters of the proxies, as it were, directly, even in the scope of these provocations. Russia seemed to tolerate this because most of the time the Israeli attacks seemed focused on Hezbollah. Never mind, of course, that Hezbollah was one of the most potent forces fighting the jihadis on the ground, and that includes Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But, the number of Israel's own media citing the number of times that that both Al-Qaeda and ISIS fighters have been treated in Israeli hospitals, yeah, shows us clearly that there was the Israel didn't actually have much interest in those jihadis being defeated, and there's plenty of evidence that they were actively they've admitted as much that they were actively backing at least some of these Islamist rebels in the south.
Right.
Yeah, so
there was a multi-dimensional. Oh, go ahead, because I want to go to this. You know, there was a multi-dimensionality to this that, as we were looking at it, you know, a year ago. Right away when Trump, even when he won the election, even when he was rising in the polls, really, where, you know, Trump is Putin's, you know, puppet, his pet, whatever, Russia, bad guy, you know, that had been cranking up since really 2007, but, you know, major, push since 2014 and then again during the campaign. And, you know, Trump saying, you know, wouldn't it be nice to be friends with Russia and taking some, you know, spending some considerable political capital on that point. And some of us looking at this saying, no matter what he says about Iran, if he really values, you know, improving relations with Russia, he can't turn around and go to war with Iran under the current, you know, configuration of things in Syria, regionally evolving, and then, of course, you know, the Road Belt project, which goes through that area, the considerations for China. And so, you know, he has been thwarted, at least publicly, from pursuing improved relations with Russia, and you have all
in,
of the
in fact,
things that
he's
have
been
happened.
He's been pushed towards making them considerably worse than
right.
they were.
Exactly.
Even from when Obama left office.
Pushed and pulled. Pushed here and pulled there, like with the sanctions bill, for example, that they just passed 500 and whatever, you know, without him, you know.
Congress passed dictating foreign policy over the head of the executive branch.
Including adding sanctions to Iran, by the way, which nobody's bringing up right now, as they parade members of Congress to say how terrible Trump is for walking away from this deal. Well, the only thing in this deal for Iran was a sanctions relief, and those are just, you know, 510 or whatever out of 535 of those people just voted again to add to the sanctions, you know, obligation on top of them. So
yeah, there's more than a bit of partisan hypocrisy on the Democrat side of all
so,
of this.
It's like wild, but here we are now with the, you know, you've got like this multidimensional aspect to it, and I'm wondering if the, if there's an impact on, you know, if we're not getting forced into, you know, a confrontation with Iran because it's been decoupled from an improved relationship from Russia, or, you know, however this is all playing out. Like, I wanted you to maybe roll that around a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm part of at least some political figures, Washington and rationale behind the handful that had the idea of improved relations with Russia was turning Russia against both Iran and China. And, you know, I don't know how seriously that was ever considered, because I don't think there's any possibility.
Right.
I don't, frankly just don't think Russia, the Russian government, at least the current one, isn't that stupid.
Right.
And, you know, they've seen the writing on the wall. I think Putin finally learned his lesson in Libya, and that's when he decided to return to office. And of course, that's only continued with Syria and Yemen, and now this focus on Iran. So I don't think there was ever really any hope there. But, you know, you know, there's a bit of a sense. Putin, you know, of course, when he first took office, he wanted to improve relations with the rest. You know, he even talked about, Russia joining NATO or of a new security architecture. He did not want to end up as the anti-Western president of Russia in alliance with the, you know, the mullahs and in Iran and with China.
Right.
That is where events and the U.S. has simply pushed things with its own foreign policy aggressions, regime changes, and, you know, color revolutions, you know, across the former Soviet space. So he's been pushed there. You know, he's maybe not natural bedfellows with the government in Iran, but they have gotten along surprisingly well since then. I think this latest round with Netanyahu in Russia, right after the U.S. Attacks and some of the most recent Israeli attacks, there was an attack that perhaps Israel did not warn Russia about through their deconfliction channels beforehand in Russia. That was the April 9th attacks, and Russia gave a very harshly worded rebuke against Israel for that. They immediately started talking about, well, you know, our policy has been not to supply Syria with the S-300 air defense system, mostly to placate the United States and Israel. And, well, we figure that you've just abrogated these, you know, deals that, you know, backroom deals that we had with these latest attacks. So we feel free to do that now. And there was some noise in that direction. And I think a big part of Netanyahu's trip to Moscow was to make sure. And sure enough, already within since that trip, some Russian officials have come out and affirmed that there is no deal at present to send the S-300 to Syria, where they were making very strongly worded statements in the opposite direction beforehand. So once again, the delivery of S-300s to an ally is, you know, a bargaining chip. And I find this particularly egregious. Now, Russia has provided, you know, less advanced and more localized air defense systems, such as the Panzer S-1s, to Syria and so on. But they've supplied the S-400 to China. There's deals to deliver it to Iran. And I'm still don't believe this will – I hope – to God, this never actually happens.
Turkey.
But supposedly there is a deal to deliver it to Turkey, which shot down a Russian jet and has been, you know, the jihadi Disneyland central for shoveling, you know, arming, training, and supplying jihadis into Syria. There is no Russian soldier who has died in Syria that has not died without some of their blood on Erdogan's hands. Yeah. So I find that particularly repulsive. But I still believe that's a bit of of bluff towards the U.S. On both of their parts. We'll see how that actually plays out. But the fact that they won't deliver the S-400s to Syria, S-300s, much less the S-400s, the S-300s, that seems to be a bargaining chip. And every indication is that Russia was warned about these latest strikes beforehand, which accounts for the low casualties all around. The highest number of casualties seem to be from Syrian air defense units that targeted the Israelis during the attack, which, you know, is I guess the minimum that can be expected.
You know,
so Russia seems to have cut some deal. But what I'm really worried about is that Israel will attempt to do what Turkey has done in North Syria. Their big complaints are always about, they can't stand an Iranian or Hezbollah presence in Syria, as if Syria doesn't have the right to choose who its allies were, and of course the allies who have helped it to fight off the jihadi proxy war that Israel has, of course, had their hands in from the beginning. So that, you know, there's a bit of complete hypocrisy there. But I'm afraid that when the Syrian government is finishing up in Yarmouk camp, which has been controlled by ISIS, and the next likely target for liberation is in this extreme south of Syria around Daraa. And I'm afraid that Israel may send troops in there to carve out a self-protection zone or a border zone within south Syria, just like Turkey has done in north Syria, supposedly to protect their country from terrorists. And then aside from the rebels, you will have the U.S., Turkey and Israel all basically claiming parts of Syria as their de facto territory. Right. And I'm hoping that whatever deal Russia struck, I don't like, Russia not getting in on this. I mean, Russia did not even turn on their air defense systems. You would think that for an ally that they have a mutual defense pact with, the absolute minimum they could have done is fired their purely defensive air defense system at unmanned incoming missiles. That would seem to be not a very provocative response, but Russia did not even do that.
Right.
So obviously there's some kind of deal cut with Netanyahu here.
And you said, though, that in terms of casualties, that they were very light.
They were very late. And it's obvious that Russia warned their allies, and that is a result of that. And
right.
Russian-Israeli relations have been improving since 1992, and particularly under Putin. Israel, even last year, recognized Russian Victory Day on May 9th as their national holiday celebrating that day. Right. And a large part of that is simply because there are an extremely large number of Soviet immigrants to Israel. That's like a third of the population right now.
Yep.
And they have significant political power, including in backing Netanyahu.
Yep.
The fact that Hamas has turned increasingly towards a hardline Islamist, even Wahhabist bent. Russia still recognizes Palestine as an independent state, they have a problem finding Palestinian interlocutors that they can deal with, and of course that's part of Israel's plan all along. Right. But Israel and Russia, for a whole host of geopolitical and other reasons, have been managing their relationship and slowly improving relations despite everything that's happening in Syria.
Mm. So. We've got about 3 minutes left here. One of the things I wanted to take a look at, because this always kind of, I don't know, it sets me thinking anyway. When they talk about, here's some S-300s, oops, never mind. You know, here's some S-400s, oops, never mind.
Psych!
Yeah,
psych!
Exactly. If you look at the things that are happening in and around Syria and some of these other spots too, by the way, it's hard not to consider the possibility that we're in, World War III or in some run up to it or, some dress rehearsal or whatever. And, some of these weapons have not been battle tested, and not just for the Russians' benefit, but for the people who are going to be the targets of these weapons, the NATO and all of that. And, I'm wondering how much of their, reticence in handing these things out and firing them and using them under battle conditions is to try to maintain, that stealth, that secret quality to it, so that when they fire them for the first time, it's a surprise to the other side. And
No, not with air defense systems. No, I see air defense systems are a deterrent. They're a deterrent against air attacks. And in order to have an effective deterrent, the other side has got to know how capable it is. Otherwise, it's not an effective deterrent.
Mm. If I'm looking to attack,
and Russia is doing a business of selling these systems to other countries,
right.
And you're right, Russia has tested over 100 new weapons in Syria, much like the U.S. does and the U.K. does in every conflict they've had in the Middle East region. And they've been testing all of these, but the air defense systems. And I believe that is because the sensitivity with Israel and the United States concerning Syria and Iran to be fair enough, even the older point air defense systems, such as the Panzer S-1, by at least Russian accounts, have proven extremely effective against both U.S. cruise missiles and, Israeli air-to-ground missiles. They have demonstrated localized systems, but a fully integrated modern high-tech system involving these S-300s or 400s should be much better. But I see a problem with not using it. I think this would be the particularly shooting down just missiles, right, rather than aiming at Israeli or U.S. jets, because that, of course, would be a very provocative step. I when they are attacking another country illegally under UN law and so on, particularly one that Russia has a mutual defense pact with, I actually don't have a problem with that either. But when we're talking, you know, just shooting down missiles, I would think that would be the perfect situation to demonstrate its capability. And the fact that they haven't, I think, is purely political, and much of it involves keeping Israel out of this at least as much as possible out of this conflict.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.